The Italian Wine Podcast is the community-driven platform for Italian wine geeks around the world. Support the show by donating at italianwinepodcast.com. Donate 5 or more euros and we'll send you a copy of our latest book, My Italian Grape Geek Journal, absolutely free. To get your free copy of My Italian Grape Geek Journal, click support us at italianwinepodcast.com or wherever you get your pods. Grazie mille. Official media partner, the Italian Wine Podcast, is delighted to present a series of interviews and highlights from the 2023 Wine to Wine Business Forum, featuring Italian wine producers and bringing together some of the most influential voices in the sector to discuss the hottest topics facing the industry today. Don't forget to tune in every Thursday at 3 p.m. or visit theitalianwinepodcast.com for more information.
Hello, hello, good morning. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. As you can see, I think this is something very useful. We kicked it off with, you have competition over there, Stephanie. She kicked it off yesterday with Wine and Spirits people. She wouldn't score, though. She copped out on me. Okay. So you guys better score today. Okay. No pressure. Okay. What I would like to do is ask you to please speak slowly, close to the microphone, because this is not translated, especially for the Italians. Okay? Slow, Jeff Porter. Please, slow. And clear and close to the mic. Now, this room was also possible to our sponsor. Welcome. And I'm going to ask Francesco Minetti to say something, just a couple of words.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I hope the first day of tastings went well. Today we are starting with this new day of tasting sessions, and we will start with Daniel Calegari and Jeff Porter, Wine Enthusiast, and they will reveal us pretty much everything, no? About their scoring method, their processes, what they are looking for in wines when they taste. So we're going to have a blind tasting of 3 wines. There will be completely secret. And hope you enjoy. And thank you for being here.
Howdy, y'all. Thank you all very, very much for having us. I'd like to, on behalf of Danielle and I, thank Stevie, the whole Wine to Wine team. Welcome for having us be a part of this. It's really exciting. As two new reviewers for Wine Enthusiast, Danielle and I were asked to join the Wine Enthusiast team in late summer of 2022. And I think our first reviews dropped in September 2022.
Probably.
I don't remember. It's been a whirlwind. But today, you know, I'm not sure what everybody's expecting, but, you know, with if you don't know Danielle and I, it's just going to be a lot of fun.
don't make promises.
I hope you like roller coasters. There, you know, this is criticism, right? We rate and judge wines. It's not, you know, Wizard of Oz. We don't want to hide anything. This is inherently a subjective role, right? But we try to create a situation where we're being the most thoughtful, honest, and forthright that we can be as individuals. So there's a system that's been set up prior to us and has evolved. Nothing is static, right? I think the death of anything is the lack of innovation. So criticism has evolved. The idea of criticism, you know, for the longest time, Wine Enthusiasts Italy was just one reviewer, and now we're two. You guys make a lot of wine, but we wanted to open the doors and breadth of what we're tasting, and hopefully we're going to give you some idea about how we approach tasting, because though we're like-minded. In many ways, we're still individual people that have different backgrounds and aspects coming to it. One last thing, just, you know, for those that don't know, Wine Enthusiast, it's a company that was founded in the 70s as originally as a place where people could buy and purchase different, you know, wine accessories. And then in 1998, the Strum family decided to start Wine Enthusiast Media, which was more about storytelling, which was more about the journalistic aspect of it. And that's where we come into play and tell the stories of you and this place and the things that we love so much. But I want to introduce Danielle didn't, and I'd never met before we joined the Wine Enthusiast team, even though we've crossed every part of Italy behind each other, in front of each other. We know the same people, and it's been an honor and joy to work alongside her this past year. And I know there's a lot more that we're working for in the future. And I just wanted to pass the mic to you and introduce yourself, and we'll get kicked off with this tasting.
Thank you, Jeff. And thank you, everyone, for being here. This is so exciting. What an amazing room full of so many people. I am privileged and honored to be here with my colleague, Jeff Porter. And speaking of us just meeting for the first time when we started working at Wine Enthusiast together, that's partly because I come into this work in a sort of non-traditional way. I am trained as an academic. I did a PhD in medieval Italian literature, and I teach Dante mostly. My passion for wine was born from having studied the food and beverage culture of the late medieval Tuscan communes. I wrote a book about Dante and the social values of food and wine in the late 200 and 300. And while I was doing that, I began to take my passion for wine more seriously in the contemporary vein as well. So Jeff and I now have had the pleasure of bringing two different backgrounds, but the same excitement and enthusiasm for Italian wine to the same platform. And today we will talk to you a little bit about how we taste, why we taste that way, and then be in conversation with you as we walk through these three wines that we have tasted just before you got here and have pretty positive feedback for you, I think, right?
Absolutely. So while we have a PhD, I barely graduated college. So that's how, you know, you get the ends of the spectrum, when it comes to that. What we want to start out with is explaining the Wine Enthusiast way. I mean, again, this is not rocket science, right? This is, we taste wine. But before we started, and what we're going to do here today is kind of calibrate all of us into the Wine Enthusiast way. So Danielle, do you want to talk about how we, introduced to this system and what we're going to do today with this first wine, and kind of we judge on the 100-point scale, and then how we come to that kind of first bracket of understanding of the way we review.
Yeah, so the first thing that we did was calibrate, so taste wine together and see if we were hitting the same marks. Jeff and I think are just lucky in that we're pretty close naturally. We share a lot of the same understanding of the way we respond to wines, and we appreciate the same kinds of characteristics. So we're pretty close on our calibrations most of the time, right from the beginning. And then because now we've had time together, that makes a difference, right? So we have both matured as reviewers over the same timeline and have talked to each other, not just about the way that we want to score something, but about the way we want to position the context. The point scale is not ideal. We know all of its many flaws. I'm sure everybody has lots of opinions about it. We do too. But it is a way of communicating, particularly in, for example, a room where not everybody's speaking the same language. So there's utility to it, if not perfection. When we talk about the scale, we do have ranges, as you can imagine. So the policy of if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all means if it would come beneath an 80, then you politely decline to reflect upon it further. If it's between 80 and 85, that is a correct and fine in the original sense of the word in English, wine. If it is between the 85 to 90 range, it is a very good wine. If it is between 90 to 94, it is an excellent wine. And if it is 95 or above, it is an exceptional wine. Obviously, ranges then become a little bit more subjective. We are talking about taste, after all, at the end of the day. And so when we meet as a team, as we will next week for our...
This Friday.
Sorry. I have no idea what day it is or what time it is. I'm also very congested, so that'll be perfect for tasting. As we meet on Friday, we will meet with our whole team for every region's coverage for the magazine and get feedback from each other, seeing where we lie. And if people are starting to verge in different directions, we'll talk about why and how to bring that back together. So we want to start right away.
So everybody here, we're going to calibrate. So the other big important thing that we've talked about, we taste blind. So what does that mean in our sense is we don't taste like totally blind. We don't know the producer. But with a calibration tasting, when we first do it, we're just looking at a qualitative, you know, kind of in your own, it's interesting because we come from different backgrounds with regards to wine tasting. I have a very didactic, master sommelier trained kind of way of tasting wine. And Danielle comes at it from her more academic background. And that's where we kind of align the point structure before we start tasting. So what we're going to do here is we're going to take 2 minutes, taste this wine, and then we're going to do a polling. So again, to go through, so 80 to 85 is like, it's a fine wine. Like it's, how would you say it? I always like to say if I'm at a wedding and they're pouring this wine, I would drink it. Because there's plenty of weddings I go to where I just revert to beer or cocktails or nothing, which has happened before. They're like, why aren't you drinking, Jeff? And I was like, oh, well, sorry.
Nightmares do exist.
And then, you know, 85 to 89 is really good wine. 90 to 94 is exceptional wine. And then 95 and above is like rock your socks off in its different forms. So let's try this wine together. And we're not going to tell you what this is. So this is just our calibration as a whole room coming together. And again, the other thing is, while you're tasting it, the one thing that we're trying to do is not just, you know, we're not winemakers. We're not approaching it from the winemaking side. We know the technical know-how of winemaking. But we're approaching it from a consumer standpoint. That's a really important focus. This is not just my own vision of what wine is, but we have, you know, our total impressions across all forms of the media for wine enthusiasts is about 5.4 million people. So we have a lot of data coming back, and we want to ensure that we have a broad reach that we're talking to our consumers.
Yeah, as Jeff is saying, we are thinking about how to make people who don't feel like experts in wine understand the wine that we have in front of us better. So we're thinking about what we like about it, what we think is done well, what we think might be some areas of weakness, but then we're also thinking about what the average person in America, which is a big, old, wide category to start with, might think about this wine, how they would receive it, and how we can try to bridge the gap between what we're feeling or noticing and what the way that people can be a lexicon that works for a very broad audience to express that.
Absolutely. And then the other thing, you know, like I gave you 2 minutes. You're like, Jeff, how can you assess a wine just in 2 minutes? It takes a lot of practice. I've been tasting wine for a very long, long time, and you pick out structural elements and all the things that go, but you come back to it. It is... When I first started reviewing it, it takes a lot longer than I'd imagine it would. You know, it's interesting because coming from the sommelier background, we taste really, really fast in a meeting. But now it's fun to kind of take the time and come back to wine and see how it evolves, because we also want to put those in our notes as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think the first couple of months I was taking twice as long to taste through the same amount of wine as I do now. So it is also a great reminder that, like anything, it's about training, about getting yourself into shape. So we taste in a specific way, and we've gotten better at that particular style of tasting, and our ability to move what is happening into our minds into, again, that language that speaks to a wide audience.
Do you want to walk through the wine on your side, and then we'll ask the room? So we're going to see how Danielle tastes now.
I mean, so you have the technical taste. I did wine certifications too, so I know the way that Jeff is talking about tasting, but it's also, you have to be a little more efficient than that, frankly. So the way that I do it is sort of in three stages for myself. First step is gut reactions. Quickly jot down everything that just comes into my mind and a range of points that I feel like this is just, after enough practice, you feel confident about that. Then I move to indicating some more specific notes. What aromas am I getting, sentori? What are the kind of contours of this wine? Is it in the category of something full-bodied or something lighter and more ethereal? Is it, you know, texturally, how am I noticing the way that it creates a mouthfeel? Again, just cutting through as much kind of raw data as I possibly can. And then the third stage is first of all, anything very specific or unique about this wine, something that's standing out to me that particularly denotes its quality or its distinction. And within that stage also, is this wine representative of its category? And what will our consumer who we're trying to speak to think of this wine? I tease, you know, the team always laughs and says it's Brunello for breakfast again. Every day I come in, I usually have a couple of racks of Brunello to go through. Brunello is a wine that has a very specific stylistic identity. So I am saying to myself, is this representing what people are looking for when they're out shopping for Brunello? And if it doesn't, is it doing something unique that's interesting and worthwhile, or is it going off map in a way that would be confusing and actually more of a challenge to our consumer?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So do we want to poll first, or do you want to walk? Let's poll first. Okay. So just by show of hands, 80, who rated this between 80 and 84? Okay, small cluster. Between 85 and 89. 90 to 95. 95 or above.
Yeah, we were both way more generous than you guys.
I don't know. The 80. So the 85 to 89. So we were in the 89 to 90 range on this wine. So we are at the upper end of the really good and the lower end of the super good. You want to talk why?
Yeah. So this is a solid 90 for me.
I guess the thing that we forgot to say is we've divided Italy into two ways.
I take the South.
The Queen of the South. And how do we define the South? Because as we talk to most
South,
to,
as you know.
Most Italians, the South is anything below you.
Yeah.
Geographically, and so like I feel like if you're in Trentino Alto Adige, all of Italy is the South. But we split it. We split it kind of a little more geographic than that.
Like, yeah. Well, they when I came on, they asked me what part of Italy in my dreams would be my territory, and I said I'll take the South. I don't need anything else. And they called me back and they said, well, you can definitely have the South. And then they said, but you have to take Tuscany too. And I said, oh, all right, fine. But I lived in Florence for many years, and I did a big part of my PhD in Pisa. So I do have a quite close relationship with territory besides my training in an official sense in wine, which always brings you to Tuscany, whether you like it or not. And I, as a result of that, have a really interesting panorama because the South is a very big place, as everybody here probably knows, in terms of representation and style. So am I allowed to say where this is from?
Yeah, you can say where it's
okay.
from.
Okay. So this is an Etna Bianco. And if you didn't know, I would have known, right? When I come into the office, I know what regions I'm tasting, how much vintage variation there is, what the panorama looks like for the day. So I can choose where I'm going to go from really big tannic reds down to high acid, light and bouncy whites, or, you know, depending on how I think I'm going to be able to manage the load that I have in front of me. It's very psychological, but, you know, your teeth and gums start to hurt after a while also, and you start to get a lot of acid reflux. So you have to think about that. So if I had this Etna Bianca in front of me, if I didn't know that, I probably would have right up front been pretty confident, because this is showing as it should, I think. It's a very representative Etna Bianco. It has a lot of Sicilian agrumi, citrus notes. It has that great salinity, almost like, this is not a note that I would write down because people don't think this sounds nice, but doctor's office, because it's sort of clean, salty, a little bit of that sea air freshness. We mentioned before that one of the things that comes to me, this is a very personal note, I think of a salted lemon slice. And if I get that up front, I'm like, this is where it should be. This is how it's talking.
It was interesting when we tasted these independently of each other. My first note was like preserved lemon, kind of like Moroccan lemons that are preserved. They're slightly salty. And that's that kind of interesting thing where that note really stood out for both of us.
Yeah, I think actually, although I'm speaking of things that you shouldn't say in front of an audience like this, I don't think notes are very helpful. I mean, the problem is that that's the most subjective part, right? What's jumping out to you, the phenolic compounds that are present, there's a mixture of them, and some things will be more present to certain tasters than others. But Jeff and I, very frequently, I would say we'll have like the same top five notes. So that is helpful for us in understanding if we're happy with where something is, or if we think it's, again, diverging from the expectation.
Do you want to break down why you scored this weight the way you did? What were those components coming together that allowed you to be like, okay, I think this is like between an 88 and a 90?
I think I'm looking for, I think most people would kind of line up with this in the sense that I'm looking for a wine that feels integrated, harmonious, has, just the very fact that I can call out some clear notes right away is always a good sign, right? This wine is speaking, right? So that's something that I think is, puts it right into that range of being, towards the, you know, middle to higher end of our scoring apparatus. Then I'm saying to myself, does it have some of that persistence that I want? Does it have, is the narrative on my palate present, beginning, middle, and end? I'm still feeling the acid, so that's a good sign. It's early, so this wine has a real advantage because it's the first thing that I had besides half of a feta biscottata. So, it's a wine that, as I said, I was able to recognize its sense of place. And so that, again, leaves it right in that range for me. Then I'm looking for, is it doing something that makes it really stand out to push it into the next level?
And then once you have kind of all that framework of notes, because we do it similar but differently, because I'm kind of in the same manner, but like, I always find this interesting in talking to Danielle. I was like, then how do you take that and then to distill it down into the review?
Well, that's where things, I think, change a lot according to the quality of the wine. Because if we're talking about something stratospheric, it's going to be a lot more of a story about what this wine is doing experientially, as opposed to a wine that is just shooting down the middle. And in that case, I'm going to, again, right, kind of outline some straightforward notes and then maybe give some indications for the atmosphere or environment in which I think that I would enjoy that wine, or when and where for it. And if it's something that isn't really speaking to me very much, then I'm going to probably try to figure out something that is, again, useful for our end user. So is there something texturally unusual about it? Or what are the things that are pulling it outside, again, of that central range?
And again, if you have any questions, please.
Yes. I know the vintage.
The vintage.
Yeah, it's 21.
It's 2021.
Yeah.
So we're going to do wine number two, but you know, you can taste it as I talk. So the other thing that we want to provide is kind of the context. So the day before we schedule our tasting, I email there's a whole tasting team. It's not just like us sitting at our house. We go to an office. If you're a producer, you may know the kind of the spiel. There's a form you fill out. You send the form to us. We look at the form. We're like, okay, yes, we accept this wine. Then it's sent back to you. Then it goes. It's not super efficient. We're working on that process. But once the wine's in house, it goes directly to the Valhalla office. From there, it gets inputted into. There's this gigantic database, which is really cool to look at from our end. And then the team has it all lined up, has it all in its brackets, is what we call it. And then they say, okay, Jeff, based upon the editorial schedule that's coming up for the next few issues, you need to taste through Malvasia from Friuli. I'm all like, okay. And then they'll be like, you have also Dolcetto, you have Barbera, you have some Frangicorta. How do you want to taste it? And so I organize my tasting for the day. I email them back. This is the kind of order I want. This is the expectation. I will be in at this time. And boom. So I usually start all my tastings at 9 a.m. Just because I like tasting in the morning. And I usually taste through 9 to like 2 o'clock. And when I taste, I also write down, before I start tasting, I write my emotions down. I know that may sound silly to everybody, but your emotions play into how you feel about things, right? So this is extremely subjective. So because we don't write the immediate review right there. We take the notes, because once the wines are revealed to us, then we have to do research to write the notes. Because if there's an exceptional wine, we're like, wow, you want to kind of add more context to it. So let's say there's a wine that's grown at 1,000 meters on Etna. You know, we may put that into the note to give the reader a little more information about it. So we have to do a little more research behind the scenes to find out more information about the wine. Because when we have it, all we know, so wine number 2, I'll let you know. So if you were walking in the office, this is Malvasia. This is from Friuli. And it is 2021. That's what I will know. So I'll have a flight of those wines. Usually we have a flight of 6 wines. And we try to keep it within its category. So let's say if not enough Malvasia had come in, let's say only 3 producers sent their Malvasia, I may just have a flight of 3. Or it could be like Malvasia and then another aromatic white varietal, but they'll tell me what it is. And that way, because context is important, a 96 on a Lambrusco, I'm not saying a 96 Lambrusco is equivalent to a 96 Barolo. They're separate. They're different. I'm not judging the wines against each other. I judge a Lambrusco as a Lambrusco and a Barolo as a Barolo. That's really important, that I hope everybody understands that, because that would be, it's not about fairness. It's just like, how do you judge a Barolo versus a Lambrusco? I mean, a Frizzante red wine made from a different grape from a different region versus Nebbiolo. That would be taken out of context. So we try to keep that contextual component together. So I know in my brain, I have kind of benchmarks that within this set, I know based upon past reviewing history, that these are kind of the benchmark wines. I have, luckily through tasting through a lot of years, I have a lot of notes. I've been taking notes on my phone for maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years now. And there's like tons of data I have that I rehash, and so I can go back and look at my notes and be like, okay, here's kind of what I'm pulling out for this year is my benchmark wines. So on this wine, if you want to taste it, so when I taste, I'm sort of the same thing. First thing is always a gut reaction. How does it make me feel? Like, the one thing I'm looking at about wine isn't necessarily just all the structural, not all the intellectual components. Wine is a feeling. Wine is emotion. Wine should most often be fun, right? This isn't just a total intellectual pursuit for me. I drink wine because I like it a lot, and not in the crazy like it a lot way. I really have a lot of fun with wine. It takes me to another place, and my passion for wine and my excitement for having this opportunity is hopefully to turn some people on. Like, I'm from, and I've said this a lot, if you've ever watched anything I've ever done, I'm from a really small town in Texas. I'm not from wine culture. I'm not from a place where that's normal. But what I want people to realize is that through drinking wine, you can be in another place for a momentary part of time. You can be in Friuli. You can be transported somewhere. I always call like wine a staycation, right? It's a little moment, a blip in time where I can just relax and enjoy something. So I try to convey that in some of my reviews and also have that thinking about the wine.
Italian Wine Podcast, brought to you by Mama Jumbo Shrimp.
Like for me, obviously this jumps out because it's an aromatic varietal, right? And I'm looking for kind of some of the correctness in knowing Malvasia. One of my biggest issues with Malvasia that I think it is at a lower qualitative standpoint is what I call my quote is European soap. If you've ever been to a bunch of like hotels in Europe, and this could be in France, it could be in Germany, there's like a certain smell to European soap that American soap doesn't have. And it's this weird soapy quality I call it grandma's perfume. These aren't notes that I write in here, but that's kind of a qualitative standpoint that I'd be like, okay, if it has that kind of smell, those are some terpenes that are off, right? That's pushing a little of the phenolic compounds in a way that kind of can make the wine a little disjointed. For me, what I love about this wine is this combination of kind of ripe, fleshy peach, stone fruit. And it's hard because this is the biggest challenge, right? That I think all of us in this room and the wine media are kind of facing is, you know, wine descriptors are also inherently personal, right? So it's hard to like, my peach could be your apricot, right? You could be smelling apricot. I think most of us, how many people would say when they smell this wine, there's some form of stone fruit on it? If I said orchard fruit, what does orchard fruit mean to anybody? Just yell it out. Apple, right? How many people smell an orchard fruit on this? So how many? Citrus. So that gets really challenging, right? Because we're kind of all over the map. But Malvasia does have certain things characteristically throughout history that people have written that say, you know, it tends to have stone fruit, some orchard fruit, some citrus in just different levels. And then when you do a chromatograph on it, so like if you ran this through a gas chromatograph, you would actually see some of those volatile compounds, right? You'd see some of those organoleptic profiles that are similar to what you find in citrus or apples or peaches, which I find very, very interesting. So let's a little raise of hands for this. Who on this is 80 to 84? That's so interesting. That's the same region over there that was like that on the first wine. Tough.
I know.
Hardcore critics.
Those are the bullies.
Yikes. The other thing I also like to put into people's minds about specifically, having been a sommelier for a long time, I think of utility. How can I use the wine?
Yeah.
Right, because that's what it's at the. This is all about the end consumer. How do we use the wine? Also, that people, no matter what wine, if I taste an $8 Della Venezia Pinot Grigio or a $500 Barolo, people have worked hard. Right, there's work involved in this. I try to have this broad idea about what's going into the wine. But again, being blind, you know, we're looking at this really, really pretty use of winemaking and how that works. Okay, so that was our small group of 80 to 84, 80 to 85 to 89. 90 to 95? 95 and above. Okay, so I was 88 on this, and Danielle was 89, 90. So like, again, this is what's really, really cool. So raise your hand if you were 85 to 95.
I think that was 80, almost
so that, that, that's,
yeah.
That there seems to be some consensus. And now the big difference is when you get into those minute variations of like between 91, 92, it's in the way I look at in rate wine. And again, this is kind of like opening the door, right? It's those subtle nuances. What's the difference? Someone's like between 90 and 91. It's just that cut, right? Everything becomes finer. Everything becomes more precise. Everything becomes a little more just revealed, defined, elegant, pure. And it's, I guess it's the difference between going to, and I have to use American clothing because none of Italian clothing fits me. So, you know, like going to Old Navy or Brooks Brothers, right? And a Brooks Brothers shirt fits different than an Old Navy dress shirt. And those are minute differences that really kind of change the wine between, let's say, an 88 and a 91. It's those micro nuance. And how do you do that? It's hard. It takes practice. But we taste, each of us, last year I tasted about 2,700 wines. Just critically for the magazine, I taste more wine on top of that because we will come visit cantinas, but we can't use those visits to rate the wines. Those are informational. Those are to interview you. Those are to get bigger perspective, broader perspective. But the only ones that we can use are when we're in the office. So I think last year, I'm around, say it again. So the only wines that we can, that they bless the reviews that go into the system are when we're in the office. So then you're like, well, why do you even come to our cantina? Because we still need to have the context.
Yeah.
That's how we're able to do our job. We go to a lot of cantinas to taste. That's how we get stories, because we don't just do the reviews. We also write articles, which for me is the most fun, right? Definitely. I love putting it all together and taking the reviews and then stringing out a story. And that's the most beautiful part.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of the finer cut, that's why I think this was a good example for us of the distinction, because Jeff is a little harder on his wines than I am. I'm excited to have Malvasia from Friuli because I don't get to drink that much of it. And I was like, Haribo peach candy, perfect for breakfast.
And I don't get to taste Etna Bianca very often. And we were opposite on our scores.
We're both like a point more generous with the thing that we're tasting less often, because I think it's more exciting to our palates. And we're both more exacting with the wines that we taste a lot. We have a very clear idea of what's going on in those wines right now and how we expect them to perform. So then we have very specific ideas. My ideas for wines coming out of the north of Italy are not as precise as the regions that I'm responsible for right now, because I'm thinking about them with a finer lens on.
And I think the other thing a lot of people ask too is, like, you know, if this is so subjective and you're a critic, you know, how much does your opinion, your personal opinion, come to play? And it obviously a lot of it. But the one thing I want to make clear is that I'm not judging a wine based upon stylistic choice, unless that stylistic choice is so far out of bounds within what the denomination is. For example, Barolo is a good place to start. Some people are extremely dogmatic about traditional versus modern, right? I think we're past that. I'll be writing an article soon coming out in January or May called Postmodern Barolo. I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm tired of those monikers, right? Because it's not just what happens in the cantina, right? Think about how much, no matter if you produce wine in a very traditional sense, how much technology, how much innovation has happened within the vineyard, right? None of us are doing it like, you know, how they did 500 years ago or 200 years ago or 60 years ago. So much has evolved. Now we're taking some of those practices that were done 60 years ago and tweaking them to the modern age. And obviously climate change is having a big effect on that. But if I personally disagree with a winemaking choice, but the wine is still exceptionally well made, I'm not gonna ding it, right? I'm not gonna be like, well, I don't agree with this wine. I have to look at it more objectively, because again, there's a broader, you know, panoply of people wanting this wine. So like, it's something that has taken time to get to be like, I have to represent and make sure, you know, there's enough wine. Now, if something, let's say the oak takes away too much, you know, over time you feel how to pick out those nuances. But I'm not just gonna say you have to use Boti, or I'm not gonna give you a good score, right? That would be disingenuous, I think, because there's this great wine made in all sorts of different ways and methods. And good wine is good wine. And my final point on that is, you know, good wine should taste good, young, middle-aged, or old. At the end of the day, a great wine will just be delicious from the get-go. Will age change it? Yes. But imagine you having your child, your baby, and being like, I'm not ready for you yet. That would be ridiculous. Now, some parents may do that. But the moment my daughter was born, my life changed for the better. And watching her grow up has been amazing. That's why when I buy wine or look at wine, I love to see it in all of its stages. And we even are looking, and through the, you know, sometimes producers will submit library releases. And it's great to revisit those and re-review them because you get to see how the wine evolves.
Well, and speaking of our audience, Jeff and I both got into this game because we like Italian wine and Italian. We have our palates skew towards some of the characteristics that old world and.
That's why
Italian.
Burgundy's not as good.
Well, here we go. Yeah, it's an easy thing to say in this room, but the speaking of the American consumer. They're actually going to be almost certainly not aligned with us for our personal tastes, right? The things that Jeff and I would choose to drink on our downtime leisurely because we are having some wine to enjoy together as friends is going to be something that we would each on our personal scales rate very highly, but that probably would be a little bit tougher of a sell to the overall average American consumer day to day.
It's changed a lot.
It's starting to change, and we're hoping to make that narrative present for people. But
So we have one more wine. Danielle's going to walk us through this one. So everybody's, make sure you've got your ratings locked.
Jeff, I'm here in the back.
There you are.
I think there are questions.
You didn't do your third wine yet?
No, but we can have questions while we're tasting it.
Okay, but it's 9:41.
Okay, so everybody, this is how we taste.
I taste
3 minutes.
Okay, on wine number. Okay, I'll give you 2 minutes. So this wine is Dolcetto. If you didn't figure that out already, so obviously Piedmont Dolcetto d'Alba, 2022. I love Dolcetto. Everybody, if you're growing Dolcetto, please keep it in the land. This is just going to be on my thing. It's history. Please don't rip it out. I will do everything in my power to make more people drink Dolcetto. I think it's a great wine. Okay. 80 to 85. That group? Uh-huh. Oh, one burger. Yeah, I see you.
They love it.
Oh, my God. Okay. 85 to 95. 95 and above. I was at 89 on this.
I think we both hit that, right?
Yeah, we actually both said the same score. So again, that's that consensus there. I think we're all in the same sort of world, which makes me feel kind of happy, plus or minus a little. But this Dolcetto to me kind of hits all the benchmarks. It's the one thing is like for me the one thing that kind of kept it from that threshold. Is the tannin structure was a little unresolved that didn't push it into the kind of the more elegant side of Dolcetto. But again, Dolcetto is a beautiful grape. You should drink it. And I think the one thing I really want to stress before we go is an 87 is a really good score. I know it's not going to change. Yeah. Like we all have to start talking about it to our consumers too, because everybody seems like you got to have 90 or above. That, you know, the average GPA of an American college student is like 2.4, you know, so let's just put it in that perspective.
Coming from school, it's exactly that, because every student wants to have an A+, but A+ is supposed to be reserved for the exceptional, for people who go above and beyond, who are putting in both the effort and have the raw talent at the same time. It's something that you don't usually see. And, the 87 to 89s of this world are the wine that we go to all the time.
That's where we drink.
That's where we eat lunch.
So thank you all very, very much. If you have any other questions, we'll be here throughout the rest of the day, and you can just come up and say hi. But thank you, Stevie. I know because I want to run to the next seminar too myself.
Okay.
So there we go.
First of all, I think they were incredibly, incredibly. I think both Jeff and Danielle, they were incredibly generous. Giving all the inside information. So I hope you guys got that. Listen, I have to thank all of you as well, because as you know, we're in Italy. Nobody believes it. Everybody's punctual. You know how it works after 10 years. And thank you so much for that.
Listen to the Italian Wine Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Himalaya FM, and more. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating through italianwinepodcast.com. Any amount helps cover equipment, production, and publication costs. Until next time, cin cin.